This is the Foundation for Iranian Studies Oral History Program. Today is August 19, 1986, Washington, D.C. Interview with Jumeh Farmayan. Interviewer Mahnaz Afghani. Let's start, Jumeh, by talking about your background a little bit. Tell me a little about where you were born and when.
I was born in 1953 in Boulder, Colorado, in the United States, where my father was getting his PhD at the University of Colorado. We stayed in the United States with my I have an older sister, my mother, my father, and I, until 1957, I think it was. I had my fourth birthday in Tehran. I went to first the American Tehran American School there, and then I went to the community school. And I graduated from Iran Zamin in 1971. After that, I took some time to study German and prepare myself for the Oxford entrance exam, which I succeeded in, and went to Oxford and studied Islamic history, more specifically Persian history, Qajar history of the 19th century, until 1975. And in 1975, I came back to Iran, and I wanted to go on to graduate work, but I thought I would take some time off for a year, and that's when I went into Alishtar. But I went on to Stanford in 1977 and did an MA degree in education.
So you actually did most of your education, most of your studies in English?
Everything was in English. And in fact, that's one of the unfortunate things, is that I have a very weak Persian reading and writing specifically. I don't feel comfortable with it at all, except when I was at Oxford, I had to do a lot of reading and writing in Persian. I did a lot of the history in Persian, obviously. But that's an unfortunate. My mother's also American, which was an added complication on the Persian side, but everything was in English.
The schools that you attended, were they mostly, did they mostly have student bodies of the same type of background as yourself?
Well, obviously the American school, there was all army type American kids, and I was glad to be out of there. But community in Iran Zamin, which I was from 6th grade to 12th grade, was a very wonderful international body. Yes, in terms of the Persian students that were there, more or less I would say they came from the same kind of background and families. And the international people were from all walks of life, many of whom I've kept in touch with and still see. The teachers were a very important factor in that you had young teachers that would come in from excellent schools like Harvard or Yale, and want to just teach for 1 year because they wanted to be exposed to Iran and the culture and everything, and we would benefit from that. And in fact, the man who influenced me in wanting to go and study Islamic history was an American who taught me Persian history. Actually, as it turned out, he taught it to me all wrong, and I had to relearn it at Oxford. But anyway, this was the type of education. It was really fascinating, I think.
And having this mixed nationality parents, what type of traditions and customs did you follow at home, Iranian or American?
Both, and both equally strongly, I should say, because the Persian holidays, well, I think this is actually true, the Persian holidays, in terms of a jovial sort of Zvili Nowruz. Most of the others, as you know, it's sort of the more morbid things. So we put in Christmas and Easter and those other things because of the schools we were in. In fact, community school was run by a missionary. We were required to go to chapel and celebrate Christmas and Easter and those things. So we did, and obviously with my mother, we fit in Halloween as well, come to think of it. But the Persian side of it was equally important. For me, later after I left the American school, the Persian side of it was always much more important because I wanted to make a point of being Persian, and it was always so much more. In fact, I rebelled against my mother half my life because of that. I almost resented her for being American. And so I always tried to pick up as much of the Persian side as I could. I used to have great arguments with my father for not speaking to me in Persian and teaching me, you know, the real Persian as he had it. I got it only from the cooks, basically, the Persian that I have.
And how about the religious side of it? Did you get mostly Islamic or Christian?
That is an interesting question. I certainly didn't get anything from my parents. Both of them, if anything, are agnostic, and probably know nothing about any of their own religions, but I used to go with some American friends. I used to go to the church. They were Protestant, I believe, a couple of times, and I was fascinated by that. But more interesting, I used to go with my cook to the mosque in the bazaar in Tajrish, and I used to love to do that. Even though, it's funny, I always used to be a little bit afraid, but there was sort of this sense of excitement and fear going into the mosque. And later, when as I was growing, and I went to many more mosques and areas throughout the country, I always felt that the reason of the fears, somehow for me in Iran, and I guess it's more Qom and Mashhad, really, there seems to be such a grief and morbidity surrounding those mosques that I think even in my childhood I picked up on those senses, and there wasn't really, it seems to be that. But my own personal leanings in religion, I'm neither Islamic or Christianity either. I have other interests in Buddhism and Zen.
But when you were a child, what did you think of yourself? I mean, did you think of yourself as one or the other?
Not at all. I think I just had a curiosity. I just was wondering, was there a God? And I often went in search of that question. And as I say, Islam always seemed a little bit scary for me, especially we had the Sinazan, and that was always a frightening spectacle that I used to watch behind the gates, behind the walls.
And what is that exactly?
When at Hussein's death, when they beat themselves, now it's been banned in Iran, or it was, maybe it's now since the revolution, I'm sure it's been reinstated very forcefully, but at one point it was banned, but that was when they used to walk down the streets at the time of Hussein's death, beating themselves and crying. And I remember once my mother, not being very smart, actually walked literally 10 feet from one gate to another in shorts during that time, and they stoned her. She almost didn't make it into the gate, and I mean, it just put a horrible, image in my mind about what it was.
This procession was mostly
men, absolutely mainly men, and I actually remember distinct times of seeing them with the chains and with the nails, and blood and bleeding. I remember that as a child when we lived in Tajrish, that, and then it was banned later when I was older. But I remember distinctly those scenes. And watching, so afraid that, what if this crowd would turn on us and everything, which they did on my mother, but it was her own fault at the time.
Okay, let's go now to your experiences in Al-Ashta. That's a very interesting project. And could you start from the beginning of how you came to know the project and how you became involved in it?
Well, I guess the real reason I became involved in the project, before I even knew what it was or where it was going, what its intentions were, was simply on a personal basis with Majid Rahnama, the director of the project, who is the father of a very close friend of mine, and who himself is a very close friend of mine. He had initially asked me if I would be willing to go down there if I wanted to see what it was all about, and not necessarily do anything. Which was, I believe, when he put me in touch with you, Mana Zafani, to talk about possibilities of doing things for women, whether it would be setting up daycare centers or what. I went down there, it was in September of 1975, right after I graduated from Oxford. And I really had no idea what I was going to expect. Some of my friends, Kavit Ahnama, Majid's son, had told me a little bit about it, what he had been doing on the economic side. They had a very interesting project in Shiraz also with the barefoot doctors, both for medicine and agricultural and education. And so I just assumed that I would probably be doing something with women or children, because obviously that would be the area I'd be most equipped to work with. I got there, and one of the first issues that I had to tackle was simply being who I was among who they were, so to speak. Even though Majid Rahnama and his family obviously are of a very well-known background, I think that the family from my own name has had a reputation in Iran for years that people take for granted that either we're very extremely rich or extremely, aristocratic, and had all the wrong connotations that one would want to walk into a village in southern Iran, in Al-Ashta, which is next to Khorramabad, I think it's 15 miles north of Khorramabad. I was totally the wrong person with the wrong background, the wrong name to walk into that situation. Not so much because of the actual villagers themselves who were probably they thought I was from Mars anyway, just the way I dressed as a woman and a woman being down there under those circumstances. The other women who were there were mainly foreigners, so they were not to be compared to me as a Persian woman being down there in that situation. But apart from the villagers who looked at me in a strange way, the actual project members, people who were from a different kind of educational background, I should say, and probably a different kind of financial background, though that's not necessarily a given. In this case, it would have been. And I think they had immediately preconceived ideas about how I was going to react and what I was doing there. The little rich girl come down to, you know, see what the poor people do, which was just not the case at all. And I really spent, I was in Al-Ashar a total of 6 months, 7 months, and I spent the first two and a half months just fighting my identity. Not really fighting my identity, but fighting to maintain my identity and to make them understand what that identity was, basically. And I had a lot of battles. I remember they used to play a game, because I have many uncles, 30. I think I have 30 uncles and aunts, yes I do. And they used to play a game with me in the evenings when we'd all be sitting around, you know, talking. And you remember the fact that my Persian is not, you know, so excellent as people that are raised in the Persian language. And they used to play this game with me, teasing me about my Persian and my accent and calling me Bachcha Amrikai, which is sort of a little American kid and things like that. But then also they'd say, okay, who are we going to kill tonight? Which one of your uncles should we kill? And it would be this game of me saying, oh no, we should save my uncle so-and-so because he really is a good guy. He did this, he did that, and we don't want to get killed this one. But on the other hand, we could sacrifice this one. And it was just a silly game that we were playing and of them testing me out to see how far they could push me and how far I would bend. And I think my message of trying to get across to them, I was saying, fine, you can have your preconceived ideas, but first come and talk to me, see who I am, forget the Falun Thalayan side and ask who the Juni side is. If you can deal with that, then I'm willing to deal with you on any other issues that you might have with my family, because some of them are probably true. And it was very fascinating. It took a long time for me to break those barriers and resentments, and I had was faced with a lot of coldness. They didn't want to accept me. I had to. And also, of course, Majid didn't make it any easier, because every time Majid would appear on the scene, he would have me on his right-hand side continuously. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was a lot of resentment built through that. But that was because Majid has known me since I was a child, and I think, I mean, there's a true affection there, and he just liked to spend time with me, as well as apart from the fact that he would talk to me about, he'd like to get my vision of what was happening. There was a lot of internal politics going on all the time, one group against another, and they should literally overthrow each other. And I arrived at a period of an overthrow when there were two parties, the Bafik party was the winning side, and fortunately I fell into that category so I could stay there. The other side, I think it was Ghazavi's group that had to leave because Bafik had won. But it was literally a political battlefield, and Majid would sometimes pit me, not pit me, but get my reactions to see, you know, what was going on, and that would make it difficult. So depending on whether they wanted to get a message to Majid or not, then I would be favored or not favored. It was interesting.
And tell me, how many people were involved in terms of the work team in that development project?
You know, I don't really know, but I would say in Al-Ashtar there was probably 12 of them. I lived in a village out of Al-Ashtar in Honam, and there was only me and another person, and actually it was just mainly me. And there was two other villages where they had people. And what would one person would be there, and then the truck, the, you know, the cars would come and go, bringing people in on a daily basis. But in Al-Ashtar, I would say 12 to 15 maybe. Actual workers, and then their families with them, their wives, their children, the doctors all had their wives, and they would do things there. The wives were either nurses or would work in the project. Mm-hmm.
And this covered an area with how many, what kind of population?
And I started a population of 6,000. Hunan had a population of maybe 200. Mm-hmm. Pedesk was another village not far from Hunan, had a population of about a little over 200 maybe. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong. You know, it may be, Hunan might have been smaller than that. It may have only been about 150 or 100. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't enormous. The population was not enormous. There was a few other smaller villages in outskirts areas which would have 20, 50 population, you know, that we were trying to touch with them. And that's where, in fact, the barefoot doctors would go to those littler camps in the mountains and in the outskirts. And roads were being built to get access to them. That was, in fact, one of the main parts of it, was trying to get roads and get access to these smaller villages, literally little hamlets in the mountains. That's a beautiful, beautiful mountain area. We'd ride horses. It was lovely.
And the group, the working group, was divided into various areas.
Right. Medical, agricultural, and education. Those were the three groups. The medical, I think, was probably more defined of the lot and knew where what they wanted to teach. They were really teaching first aid, basically. And bringing in the teenagers, I'd say, you know, people from 15 to 21, 22, mm-hmm. and teaching them about the basic anatomy, teaching them about wounds, how to care for wounds. There was one doctor that Dr. Hamidi, a very interesting character, he came in later when I was living in Hunan, and he started a gynecological clinic, mm-hmm. which was a major a source of curiosity and conflict, because the women did not want to submit to a man, you know, sort of dealing with their gynecological needs. But that was interesting. But previously, that was not part of the the Behrars, the medical section. In terms of, they did have midwifery, obviously. That was very much part of it, but not for a man. The women would only do that. It was not the male doctors that would do that. On the agricultural side, I don't know that much about, really. They they would bring in different animals, which was crazy. They brought in this huge, what is that huge cow, that bull, yeah. You know, for breeding purposes. It's a special name. I forget what the name is, but it's one of those huge American bulls. And all the complications of getting that bull to mate and this, that, and the other was very funny. And there was a big laugh there. I mean, it was a big joke. And then other things about planting and teaching people about erosion, what kind of seeds, trying to get them to plant the different kinds of seeds. The villagers were often against it. You know, they said, no, we're doing just fine with our, I think it was soy product they were producing at the time. These kind of things. The education side is what I was dealing with. There were two types. One was the education of the elder, which was the literacy program. I didn't have anything to do with that. There was also the education of making teachers. Mm-hmm. There was the teacher training program, so to speak. That was a very interesting program. I wish I could be involved in it, but again, because of my lack of Persian, I was simply not equipped to do that. I dealt with the kindergarten, and when I arrived there was a Dutch woman, I don't remember her name any longer, who was handling that program, and she had set up, had managed to get a hold of a building. I suppose the project had got it for her, and it was a brick concrete building with very little facilities, and I remember that it was divided into the four corners. It was one room divided into the four corners of the room. It was fairly large. And then she had her teachers, who were around the ages of 19 to 26, older than me. I was, I guess, 21 at the time. And she would be training these four teachers, and she was going to be leaving in about 10 days after I arrived, and I was meant to just take over, having had no experience at all in any of this. At the same time, that building which they had acquired was going to be lost. I think the person who had rented it wanted it back, whatever the case was. That building was going to be, we would have to give it up. And we went in search. One of my projects was to go and find another room, another area with these teachers, because they knew the people of Alashta. And so I would go with them, and we would see, you know, how we could talk to the people and get the rooms for the project. It was very interesting. Those girls, those four teachers, were very, very interesting. It was some of their parents didn't want them doing this. They, women shouldn't be exposed, shouldn't be working, shouldn't be doing this kind of things anyway. But what was curious was is that in the classrooms, these were girls and women who themselves, you see, the Dutch woman had, I don't know by what means or ways, had actually acquired all sorts of Western toys, you know, dolls, cars, all sorts of, you know, educational toys, Fisher Price even, and all that. And, I mean, these girls were like children more fascinated with the toys than the kids themselves were, you know, it was really interesting. And I had a lot of problem with that whole concept. I felt, you know, when these children go home, they don't go home to Fisher Price under any circumstances. And they barely go home to, you know, some of them were extremely poor. Some of the older, some of the people in the villages were not so badly off. In fact, I remember there was the man who used to bring in the oil to the village. He was extremely well off, and his children were well off. You could tell the way they were dressed. You could tell by their cleanliness. These were all differences you could tell. But some of these children were extremely poor, and it really hurt me to see them. They come in, they see all these fascinating things, and they go home to nothing. And not only do they go home to nothing, but when they go into first grade, they go into less than nothing. They go into worse. The first grade there was the first grade to sixth grade was a room literally twice the size of this table. What is this table? I mean, it was maybe 6 by 6. A small room, dark, no windows, a blackboard, and a teacher with a whip. You know, it was really your classical medieval schoolroom situation. And I'm thinking, these poor children, here they are, here in this rosy situation of toys and I don't know, stories and fairy tales and snacks. We used to make sure that was one of the requirements, was that they got a daily snack of either a fruit, but always milk. We would bring that in. I mean, that for many of them was their main source of nutrition, which was one of the greatest things about doing that whole thing. Would they go from that to you know, nothing at home? My feeling about that whole thing was I say this now in retrospect, now that I've been to, you know, I've studied education and I've seen my own children grow up and I've seen nurseries, and it's easy for me to say it now. At the time, I myself, I don't think, though I had a sense that this wasn't right, I don't think I would have had any of the answers. I'm not saying that at all, but what they really needed at the time was things that they could develop. And we tried this to a certain extent, feebly, from their own natural resources, creating toys, creating activities, creating something from their own natural resources. I think that was crucial. And making them understand through that their own life and working from there into bettering it. But again, Alain Stern, unfortunately, was a victim of the whole, ironically, because Najid would want anything but this. Mm-hmm. But ironically, again, it was a victim of the whole Westernization concept. Mm-hmm. It was really a question of, instead of coming in and finding what you have and building upward, coming in from outside and putting inward, which just often just does not work. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, in that case, it didn't. So, and it was funny how those girls, of course, I think maybe because I was younger, but also because I was Persian, you see, with the Dutch woman, she was a total stranger, a new entity, and they really didn't know how to put up fronts with her or whatever, and anything she said must have been right because she came from Europe. Mm-hmm. But I was Persian, I was young, they were there before me, they had already worked with her. Her name was Yvonne. Her name was Yvonne. They had already worked with Yvonne, and they felt, and probably rightly so, that they knew a great deal more about it than I did. And they weren't so ready to work with me, though. I think in some cases they had an incredible fascination about me. They wanted me to come home with them. They wanted to talk to me, wanted me to talk to them, even about my boyfriend, about anything they wanted to know. They wanted to, you know, they even wanted me one time to undress so they could see what my underclothes were like. I mean, it was really interesting. They didn't ever feel they had the right to be like that with Yvonne, but I was Persian. And yet at the same time, they also felt that they didn't have to listen to me. It was a very delicate balance of trying to work with them and at the same time be a friend with them. And I guess, sorry, did you want to?
Did these girls live with the other working people there?
No, they were of the village. They were Alashteri, and they lived at home. Mm-hmm. And they would come in the morning, they'd do their work, and then the kindergarten worked from 9 to 12, just like in America.
Mm. And then the workers though had their own compound? What did they
work? No, the doctors had their own compound. It wasn't a neat compound, it was just that the medical system was set up there and it had to be in a better facilities. They needed better facilities, so they had their own compound for that reason. But a lot of the people, they had their own rooms. When I was in Anashtar, where did I live? I lived in a room with, I don't remember who I lived with, but in the village. Mm-hmm. The villagers would give rooms. We'd rent rooms from the villagers and we lived there. But there was a project headquarters, where we had our meals. Mm-hmm. There was a cook there, and the head of the project, the director, had his office there, mm-hmm. and there was a conference room there. Mm-hmm. And also the cars would be, they had a garage area, an area where the cars would be kept. Mm-hmm.
Was it easy living with the villagers? Was there any antagonism, any curiosity, anything?
There was a lot of curiosity, but mm-hmm. I didn't feel antagonism at all from the villagers. Mm-hmm. Now, I moved out of Anashtar, which was really a little city. It wasn't a village. It was, it had all the electricity and everything of a little village, of a little city. I moved out and went to Honam, which was a village that grew up around a beautiful little Cheshme spring. Mm-hmm. And they had no electricity there. Mm-hmm. They had no toilets, no facilities. There was an outhouse that one had to go to. And I moved there all by myself, with into a two-bedroom house. A two-roomed house. That was it. Sum total. And I had one room, and then there was two other people had the other room, and they would come and go, mm-hmm. because most of their work was in Alash there, mm-hmm. and I think basically they were there to keep me company. And as it turned out, then I ended up having a relation with one of them, so which was also very complicated.
These were workers in the group.
These were project workers. Yes. Uh-huh. And one of these people. Do you want to know any of this or not?
Yes.
Because he was the director of the project. This was Hushain Bafik, and he came from a village in the north, right on the tip of the Russian border, mm-hmm. The northeast of Iran, very interesting, and probably a village not much bigger than the one that we were living in at the time, though he was the Kabkhoda there. His family was the main head of family there, I'm sure. Bajgiran, mm-hmm. that's where, in fact, his name was Bafik or Bajgiran, that's the name of the village that he came from. And and the other one was an Isfani Niazi, a wonderful character called Niazi. Anyway, they would come and check up on me to make sure I was all right. But the villager, there was a wonderful man who took care of me. He was a villager there, Khair Ali. Mm-hmm. And he was my guardian angel. And he absolutely, it was incredible how much this man loved me. And it developed over time, but I used to spend hours with this man talking to him about his life and about his children and about the village life, the history of the village of Honam, which was, as I say, a very small village with everybody, every baby included, maybe 150. Mm-hmm. There were 27 Khanavad, there were 27 families. So if you put 27 times 5, it runs about that, yeah. Anyway, he was a fascinating man, and it was incredible that he had no qualms about who, what, or where I was, my name, nothing. Of course, my name didn't mean anything to him, but he just had such an affection for me, this man. To this day, I can't tell you how guilty I feel that I haven't been in touch with him, because I'm sure he still thinks about me, what happened to me. He wonders, and the day I left, this man was crying like a baby. Anyway, my education in that village, great deal came from him. Really,
what do you think of you, a woman, being so far away from home?
Well, coming from Tehran already was as good as coming from Mars, quite frankly. And being a woman, it was just another dimension to that. It was so awe-inspiring that, you lived in a house in Tehran and this, that, and the other. That I think everything was beyond that. There was no longer a sexual implication anywhere. It was really dealing with a separate entity, at least in Khair Ali's eyes. And it was very funny because
he used to beat his wife. But I mean beat his wife, pull out her hair, and I used to have to go and reconcile them. And I used to have the biggest fights with this man, and I'd say, for God's sake, you love me, would you ever lift your little finger to me? Why? I'm the same human being as your wife. There's no reason why, you know. And but I was a separate entity. It was very funny. For his wife was just another lesser human being, literally. A lesser human being, and I think that's how a lot of them looked at their wives. And he had ownership over her. That's what he would say to me. He owned her. That was his image of her. But he would say to me, "You're right. It's wrong. It's terrible." And when he would beat her and she would leave, go to her father's house, he would come and ask me to go and bring her home. And I'd say, "No, I'm not going to do it." I mean, I got to the place where I said, "Then you're going to have to do it yourself." And I think eventually, by the time I left, I wasn't that long there, but it happened often enough that by the time I left, I think he was willing to try and talk things out. That's what the message I was trying to get across to him always is, if you have a problem, you don't have to beat, you can talk. You can talk about it, or leave if you're still angry, you want to hit, leave the room. And I think eventually he was coming around to it, because when I left, she came to me and she was asking me not to leave and telling me that he had been much better to her now. So at least that's one good thing.
Were they having children?
He had two little children, and they were all the children in that village were undernourished, if not malnourished. There were some children that were just downright malnourished. One of the things that I didn't, when I got into that village, I just threw up the whole kindergarten project. I said, this is ridiculous. First of all, there was no concept of education for these preschool. I mean, the school concept, first grade already was, you know, a difficult enough concept to deal with. And I just felt that at that age, if there was any way I could get the mothers to relate to the children, we've come a long way. There was no way that they were going to, the children already, you're talking about a different concept of childhood there. The children of five were already working. The girl of five was carrying the two-year-old on her back. She had responsibilities, she had requirements. It wasn't as if she was a carefree, happy child that you see, you know, anywhere in a developing city or a developing country. It was a whole different idea. And yet these children, you can, for me at least, the biggest problem, all that you could say would be fine, let them grow up young, whatever. But what happened was their eyes, this is what scared me, was looking at these children's eyes, they were blank. And these children didn't ask questions, and that really bothered me. And I was trying to get the mothers to interact with their children, just talk to them. I didn't care about what. These mothers never talked to their children. It took me, Lanaz, it took me the full 7 months of being there. And even to this day, I mean, it's only because I want to believe it that I'm convinced that there is really, how shall I say, I mean, there's a tremendous love for the mother and child. There's no question about that in my mind. But the kind of love that you and I or any other person understand, it's not the same. That child has a function in this world. That child for that mother has a function. That simple, pure adoration is what was lacking. The love was of what this child was bringing into the family. There was a case of an orphan. Her name was Elan. And this orphan, there was a mother taking care of this orphan because the father was paying her to give her milk. The mother had another child who was breastfeeding, and the father had given this child to breastfeed, this baby Elan. She was about 18 months. Absolutely adorable child, totally malnutritious. Not a question of undernutrition. The child is definitely the Biafran type, got the stomach, the thin arms, a really very, very sad case. Well, the father died. And the mother was just literally going to throw this child out because the child no longer served the purpose. Before, the father was paying the family. They were eating off of what he was paying. It happened to be the poorest family in the village as well that had adopted this child or had agreed to take in the child for milk reasons. And so I set up a foundation for that child. All my salary, I put it aside in a fund. And in fact, I had Khair Ali as the executor of that fund. I put it in a bank, and in fact, Hushan Rafiq helped me. We set it up, and that on a monthly basis, they would get X amount of money that would feed the family on the condition that they promised that this baby would be well-nourished and cared for and loved. And it was incredible. As soon as that was done, the transformation that this woman had towards this child, you know, and I think that what really needed to be done then and today, anywhere in this village, is to establish a type of communication, but it's a vicious circle. I mean, the mother never had it either. Mm-hmm. And it's really, that's the real education process that needs, that with the mother and the child, the women issue there. It was really trying for me. I used to have them come in every week. I'd have them come in, weigh their children. For mothers that didn't have milk, I had arranged, and I almost regret it, you know, I had arranged to a friend of mine in Tehran, Mehdi Abdul, had a dry milk factory. Mm-hmm. He would give it to me free. Mm-hmm. Tons and tons, as much as I wanted, he would give to me. And I would take down to Tehran. Whenever I'd go to Tehran, it wasn't often, I didn't go very often, actually. In the 6 months I was there, I think I went to Tehran maybe 3 or 4 times. But I would bring in this SMA milk, this dried milk, and give it to these mothers. Now, probably I did years of disservice by doing that, because they did not, I mean, it was only through ignorance. I was trying to help, but I now that I know all the facts about the dry milk, the lack of sanitary conditions that go with it, the dilution, it probably was much worse for these kids. But some of the mothers literally did not have milk. Some of them said they didn't. I don't know. Mm. Anyway, we would come and we'd weigh the babies. I had gotten a weight. And then we'd talk, and they were just beginning to open. And that was really, and they were curious about me. They didn't dare to be curious about me before. I mean, really, I was such a strange entity. How could a woman be living alone in their village doing these kind of things? Walking around in jeans, whoever heard of such a thing? And on top of it, but I was also making such an effort to be like them and to only eating what they were eating and, you know, living in the same fashion and all that. I think in a sense, that was even more bizarre to them. Had I maintained my own Western standards, they would have been able to respect me more, because then it wouldn't have been, I think, a contradiction. I think there's a big fallacy that many people have when they go into villages in Iran, or when they travel in Iran, or when whatever, the work, they're always trying to emulate the people there, whereas in fact the people there don't expect it and they don't want it of you. They really don't. You've come there to do a service, you've come there to do something, they expect you to do that. They don't want you to copy them. They think they're miserable. Mm-hmm. Why would anybody want to copy them to be miserable? Mm-hmm. And it's exactly true. I mean, in a lot of societies, there's this over-glorification of poverty, you know? And I think that in my ignorance and youth, or whatever you want to call it. But anyway, slowly these mothers started coming in, and I started a nutrition program. And through the nutrition program, of course, what nutrition? I mean, this woman that I'm telling you, Iran, they're literally, I mean, they had meat, if they were lucky, once a month. Not once a week, once a month, if they were lucky. In fact, one of the requirements that I set down in that, when I put up the foundation for Khair Ali, Khair Ali benefited from that too, I made sure of that, but was that they should have meat. They should acquire meat by whatever means, because they had the finances to do so, at least once or twice a week for these children and themselves, the mother and the father. But through the nutrition program, and I was trying to bring on an education for these women that if their health was good, they would be feeling better. If they were feeling better, they would have more energy. If they had more energy, they could do more work. If they could do more work, they could et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of, a tremendous amount of lethargy, tremendous, just through the lack of nutrition, through the children as well as the mothers. And trying to get them to understand that you can communicate with your children. Your children, you can talk to them. These children have to have curiosity. These children have no curiosity.
Who did the women communicate with?
I guess the women would communicate among themselves, but there was a very strict hierarchy in that village. There was, as I said, there was the, in that village also there was the person who brought in the naph, the oil. Mm-hmm. There was the head of the village, the previous head of the village, who had now lost face because the project had overruled him. And then there was various degrees of farmers, depending on the wealth of how much they had, you know, reaped from the land that year, and to their standing in the village. And all this had a great deal of importance as to who could talk to who. I mean, it wasn't, you know, if you were on the lower end of the farming scale, you didn't just walk up and talk to the person who was bringing in the oil, who was the financially better off person. And I got all the family history, and I wish I had it, I don't, of each household there. How many people lived in the houses, what each occupation was. Well, they were all basically farmers, I suppose. Maybe, and then who went away, how many wives, the divorce situations, which did exist, what would happen to, all these things are fascinating. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't have it with me anymore. But Khairani was my main source. Mm-hmm. And I think the women, eventually, I had a neighbor, Hamsayo, who would come over and talk to me. And she had a little girl who, believe it or not, I was teaching to read. She didn't know how to read. But I knew enough Persian to start her with the alphabet. And I would teach her. I'd work with her about an hour a day. And she would just love that. It was the greatest treat. And I would enjoy it, too. And I'd talk to her and find out about her life and her aspirations and these kind of things. And they weren't very high. I mean,
what
for
did you want?
Any of them. Well, this little girl, she was, I guess, 12. And she had heard about the BIFAS, the medical program, and she was hoping that maybe she could join one of those projects and do something, but she had to learn how to read first. And she worked at it so hard. And it was all interesting, though. It was all memorization, total memorization, because I actually tested her once. I just said, can you recite this for me? And she did absolutely off the hook. But then when I'd ask her a question about it, anything, for example, I mean, if we would be reading about the little boy, of course, that was another problem. The sources of the books, don't forget, were from Tehran. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff in there about refrigerators and God knows what else, which is totally nonsense. But for example, if I would say to her, what did the little boy go and get when he went shopping, she wouldn't be able to answer that question. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I was working on with her too, and I think that was a lot of the problem with a lot of the teachers in the teaching system. And I had brought that up with Majid too. There should be some form of a testing system and questionnaire constantly to make sure that they're taking in the information as opposed to just memorizing it. But that's a typical system anyway. But it
now,
was
so you say that the women interacted with each other
to a greater or lesser degree. I think in fact they coming to me once a week was becoming a sort of a forum where they did. But there wasn't a great deal. It wasn't like they go and have tea together. No, I mean, they didn't have that kind of time. First of all of them had minimum of 3 and some 8 children. Mm-hmm. They were always doing things. I don't know, farming or collecting seeds or sweeping up here and there. They were always coming and fetching water. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me they were always doing things or calling after this or that child or down at the spring washing the pots, you know. And down at the spring was sort of a social area. They would sometimes talk to each other. I think probably they talked about me a great deal in that village. I mean, that must have been a great topic of conversation, you know, walking around and, you know.
But with the husbands, you wouldn't notice much interaction.
In fact, I noticed. They definitely noticed no interaction. Incredibly. And this is what I'm telling you, with Khair Ali, who was the most educated of them all, mm-hmm. simply by virtue of exposure to us and these type of people. I mean, it wasn't just me, but Hushang and Niazi and all these other people in the project, whoever came to Honam, they all knew Khair Ali. They didn't know any of the other villages. Mm-hmm. I mean, they knew them mm-hmm. in Hello Goodbye, but they knew Khair Ali. Mm-hmm. So Khair Ali, by virtue of being the most educated, he still didn't even think of his wife as a human entity. He never would think of bringing his wife over and sitting over there and talking, having her talk to me or having her, you know, unless I requested it, which I did. You see what I'm saying? She was, and I think that basically that a lot of them treated their wives as just half, in Islam it's not, you know, the woman has half the right of a man. There's another interesting aspect, you know, I still don't know, and the research should probably be done on this, but I have a very deep suspicion that the people of Honam, if not the Al-Ashtar area, were Sunni and not Shi'i.
Muslims. You never talked about it.
I did, but it was all hush-hush. They wouldn't talk about it, mm-hmm. you know. But there were certain, I remember distinctly, what was it? And certainly the Hussein era there was no big deal about that. There were things that were very much underplayed there. And I don't know if it was just generally that they were apathetic to the whole religious thing or that they did have Sunni, but there were other people there, that there was a woman evidently who was a rebel in the mountains, and she was Sunni, and they talked about her, and that she had many followers. Mm-hmm. So there were some zimzin in. There was some rumor of being Sunni.
What kind of a rebel woman?
Oh, she was fascinating. I wish I could remember, Mana. The facts mm-hmm. of that woman. Mm-hmm. Incredible. She had a gun. And she was a rebel, and she was in the mountains. She was always running from away from the gendarmerie. And she had a, it was a rebel against the government, yeah.
An outlaw,
literally. But it was a woman, and that was what was really fascinating. And
what was the presence of the government there? Did you, what kind of government official did you see around there?
By the time I got there, let me think, the project must have been running at least a year before I got there. Now, evidently, according to Husheng and Majid both, I guess, when they came there, there was a very strong military presence. There was a gendarmerie there. And the project just ran them out of town, literally ran them out of town. And because of the bad experience that the villagers had had with the gendarmerie, literally raping their women, those are the stories that I was told, raping their women, there were stories of, on the wedding night, the head gendarmerie would come and say the bride has to be mine first, these kind of absolutely horrendous stories. But evidently the Quatre Cordages used to do that too. Mm-hmm. It was not out of tradition. Mm-hmm. It was within the realm of tradition. But they would take their food, they would say that you have, in terms of taxation, mm-hmm. you know, supposedly they were absolutely horrible and taxing what they didn't they have in money, they had to pay in kind. This kind of thing. So they had a very bad reputation and made it very difficult for the project to gain credibility, because as far as they were concerned, we were just another form of the government. They didn't understand what our function was initially. And Husheng used to tell of a story when he first came there. He was among the first groups that came there. And Kaver, and I'm always with him too. They were just when they were starting and they wanted to go and get a feel for it, they would go and talk to the villagers. And Husheng, as I suppose because he grew up there, grew up in a similar, it must have. I've never been to his village, but my feeling is, just by definition of where it is and what, you know, it must have been a similar type of thing, had such an incredible, he was